The book is a silent teacher and a companion in life. Those are wise words. You might be surprised that they're words by Korean dictator Kim Il-sung. And it may or may not surprise you that Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il apparently penned children's books. Indeed, both of them took a great interest in the role that children's literature played in the building of a strong North Korean state. Christopher Richardson is a doctoral candidate at the University of Sydney, and his research is focused on the children's literature of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. He's our guest at Behind the Tweed this week, which is our 5 or so minute foray into intriguing work being done in academia here and abroad. Chris Richardson, welcome to RN Drive.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Now, I want to talk about, you know, Kim Il-sung and his son and his grandson's forays into children's literature in a minute, but who are the normal writers of North Korean children's literature?
Well, in North Korea, it might be said that all children's books are ultimately written by the leaders themselves,
right.
Because they themselves have not only taken it upon themselves to write exemplary stories to be emulated by other writers, but they've also taken time out of their busy schedule developing weapons of mass destruction and the world's fourth largest army to write treatises on literary theory. So, for example, Kim Jong-il's treatise on Juche literature is, a Bible for all North Korean writers.
Right.
So in a sense, it's impossible to break out of the formal mold. There are writers who are sometimes named in North Korean literature, and you can follow their careers to a degree, but whether or not any of these people are actually real, breathing individuals is hard to determine, because a lot of North Korean literature is written by committee or written by teams in which usually men are looking over each other's shoulders to ensure that what they're writing is, you know, adheres to the norms of Juche literature.
So our concept of an author is not really something that works in terms of literature in Korea, whether it be adult literature or children's literature.
The idea of a celebrity author in North Korea is practically unheard of. I mean, you know, you write for the country, you write for the state, you write for the leader. In the earlier years of the DPRK, they had a more conventional literary culture where certain authors rose and fell according to their stature and their talents. But eventually what happened was, you know, when it came to purging writers who were transgressing against the sort of revolutionary orthodoxies of the state, it became very difficult to expunge their record if their names were known by all and sundry. You know, so from that point on, writers
became... You can't kill the Korean Dr. Seuss because you're in trouble if that happens.
Exactly. So henceforth, writers became more and more anonymous and more part of the collective.
You write that North Korean children's literature is surprisingly diverse. You also say that young North Koreans growing up reading it thought that it was still pretty enjoyable. Is it always political?
Sometimes the politics is so obvious that it's impossible to miss. Other times it's more subtle. When we're talking about politics in North Korea, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that, you know, in a sense, everything's political. So on the one hand, things that even in the West we might find very admirable and virtuous, like civic-mindedness, good manners, loving your family, loving your country, are ultimately directed towards, you know, more political ends than we might expect in Australia, for example. But that said, a lot of the tales are very extremely political, whether that be stories of the Korean War or the anti-Japanese guerrilla struggle, which are the two principal legitimizing historical periods in contemporary North Korean history. On the other hand, there are stories which are sweeter tales, funnier tales, stories which aren't that different to the sorts of stories that children might read in the West.
I was reading about the rooster and the butterfly.
That's right.
Seems like a very typical, you know, there's so many, you know, Western children's stories about, you know, think about the tortoise and the hare and things like that, which
exactly.
are like parables for, you know, parables for particular ways to behave.
That's right. Ostensibly, it's just like an Aesop's fable where it's a sort of, on the one hand, a moral that anyone can relate to. But when you dig a little deeper, you realize that these parables are very often specifically mirror the geopolitical predicament of the DPRK. So, for example, the butterfly and the rooster written by Kim Il-sung, or purportedly written by Kim Il-sung, is the story of a beautiful garden, and in North Korean literature, a garden or a village very often stands in as a symbol or metaphor of the North Korean collective, the North Korean state, this idea of a pure, untainted Eden. And in this garden, we have a group of animals, all of whom are subjected to terrorization by this great swaggering rooster who comes stomping into the garden. And all of the animals...
Has it got a Yankee flag, this rooster?
Well, you'd be surprised. He looks kind of like a cross between Colonel Sanders and perhaps General Patton.
All right.
Or more specifically, Douglas MacArthur in the Korean context. And He comes swaggering into the garden and all of the animals cower before him. And it's very clearly a metaphor for the East Asian political neighbourhood in which you've got the Chinese and certainly the Japanese and very specifically the South Korean animals, as it were, cowering under the might of the Yankee Empire. But then, of course, it falls to this one virtuous butterfly, this plucky butterfly who stands up to the rooster and says no more. And in a series of sort of incredibly violent and increasingly sort of chaotic hijinks, the butterfly ultimately deals bloody revenge upon the rooster, who I think drowns in the end. And it's interesting because all of the animals in the garden, you know, in typical children's literature style, are sort of anthropomorphized. Only in the case of the butterfly, he's more human than animal and very clearly dressed in traditional Korean clothing. And in fact, to make the point even more obvious, he's carrying around a jar of kimchi. So there's no denying that this is a Korean butterfly.
I didn't know that butterflies ate kimchi. But
well, these ones, revolutionary butterflies
can do anything. This is Behind the Toy. This is our opportunity to talk to an Australian or international academic about their intriguing work. And I have Christopher Richardson with me from the University of Sydney talking about his work on children's literature in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. How do you get your hands on these books?
Well, it's not as hard as you might imagine. Basically, buy them online. There's a, in particular, I buy them through a man in Beijing who distributes them. I think they're distributed with the intention that they'll be read by sympathetic audiences in the Korean-speaking community. Of course, they're also added, you know, there are collectors now on the scene who, you know, are furnishing their libraries with large numbers of North Korean graphic novels and comics and picture books and poems, perhaps hoping for the day when they will, you know, be extremely valuable on eBay.
Or after the demise of North Korea as we know it.
That's right. Well, one day these things will be no more, that's for sure. So they're not impossible to get one's hand on, and by the same token, you can't buy them at Dimmicks.
No. Now, what would you say are the main kind of values or tensions or themes expressed in children's literature? Obviously, one is invasion and resistance. We talked about it a bit in terms of the rooster and the butterfly. What are some of the others?
Well, the special destiny of the Korean people is above all perhaps the mission of children's literature. And in particular, the messianic role of the family Kim in fulfilling that special destiny. So North Korean children's literature, I suppose, could be broadly divided into two categories. And the first is the one we've perhaps already talked about, which is this surprisingly diverse combination of, you know, boys' own graphic novel adventures and Aesopian fables that are very colourful and perhaps in some ways not that different to things we might see in the West. But there's another category which is very specifically calibrated to venerate and indeed worship the ruling dynasty of Kim Il-sung. And these are very often stories in which the Kims themselves are the principal protagonists. And in stories for children, they are, to be even more specific, they're very often the childhood adventures of the leaders. Whereas, you know, in the West, we might have tales of Robin Hood plucking the nose of the Sheriff of Nottingham. Instead, you have, you know, Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il plucking the noses of Japanese imperialists or Yankee imperialists. And on the one hand, these are quite entertaining stories and they're sort of red-blooded adventures in a way that any boy or girl might enjoy. But there's a very deeper and very powerful political impetus that drives these, which is to validate the rule of the ruling family by suggesting that the Korean people simply cannot exist without Kim Il-sung and his heirs, and also giving children a paragon of moral rectitude and revolutionary virtue to emulate. So in a sense, they're kind of like revolutionary Sunday school stories where you actually have, you know, the leaders embodying all the virtues that they're then supposed to, you know, incarnate in their daily lives when they're at home or at school or scouting with the Korean Children's Union. But it's kind of extraordinary to sort of outside eyes and ears because so many of the claims that are made for the North Korean leaders, even in childhood, are so extreme that they defy any sort of sense of gravity or logical reason. So, for example, Kim Jong-il, although historians know he was born in the eastern maritime provinces of Russia, according to North Korean national mythology, he was born in a secret military base under Mount Paektu, the sacred birthplace of the Korean race, and that basically, much like Jesus Christ's divinity was recognized by these humble, you know, shepherds, the divinity of Kim Jong-il was allegedly recognized early on by humble peasants and revolutionaries who, as soon as they set their eyes on this boy, knew that he would be the salvation of the Korean people. And it's taken to such an extreme that, according to these hagiographies, even the Japanese emperor was given a fax warning him that a boy had been born that would soon be the hammer of the Japanese Empire. And this is before he's even, you know, sucked his mother's breast. And this is how amazing Kim Jong-il was in the eyes of the North Korean hagiographic tales that children are taught from them, practically from the day that they're born.
When you think about somebody like Kim Jong-un, I mean, how does one craft stories about him? You know, Kim Jong-un goes to university overseas, I imagine. It's probably not one of the adventure stories. But has there been some books either authored by him or having him as a character, as a central character?
It's a really good question, because what it does is it forces us to deal with and to explore the contemporary currents and contours of North Korean society. And it's really crucial to note that the North Korea of yesterday is not the North Korea of today. This isn't your grandfather's North Korea. This is not Kim Jong-un's grandfather's North Korea. And things are really changing. And it's becoming a lot harder for the state to sell the same old tales. And in fact, there was a story that about 2 years ago, the very first textbook was circulated in North Korean schools telling similarly heroic tales of Kim Jong-un's childhood. And people's skepticism was such that the book was withdrawn and rewritten, that for the first time, that the state is having to keep up with people's changing expectations of what's actually plausible. And in a sense, the old propaganda tales don't have the same traction that they used to. And in particular, since the famine which struck North Korea in the middle of the 1990s, which most of your listeners would probably be aware of, North Koreans have been forced to take their survival into their own hands for the first time. And so people aren't relying so much on the state either for their subsistence through the public distribution system or even for their cultural subsistence. People are, you know, as people took their survival into their own hands in terms of getting food, they also started trading contraband cultural materials, stories from outside North Korea, things traded on USBs and MP3 players and DVDs and VCDs across the Sino-Korean border. And this has really begun to break down the sort of false consciousness of the North Korean population. Even children now in the capital have all seen Disney movies. They're probably all seeing Let It Go. They have all had access to foreign materials, very illegally, but it's become so widespread that it's almost impossible to put the genie back in the bottle. And the question now becomes, how on earth does the state compete with this? And telling magnificent tales of Kim Jong-un's revolutionary childhood probably isn't going to cut it the way it used to. And so far, the state seems to have been very cautious in making too extravagant a set of claims about Kim Jong-un, although I have read that allegedly he discovered mountains and was a great marksman at the age of six. But that's par for the course when it comes to being a Kim.
Christopher Richardson, thank you so much for giving us a window into this fascinating world of North Korean literature.
My pleasure.
That was Chris Richardson. He's a doctoral candidate at the University of Sydney, and his research is focused on children's literature of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.